Head to the episode details and follow the link for promotional offers from PRST affiliates like Nike, Reebok, Under Armour, Rogue Fitness, Hylete, Oakley, and several others. As always, thanks for tuning in.
What's going on, everyone? Thanks for tuning in to another episode. Today, I sit down with Dr. Aaron Horschig of Squat University to talk about lower body mechanics during the big lifts. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a review. You can find my content on Instagram and Twitter, where my handle is PRST_PT. You can follow the Performance Rehabilitation and Strength Training Facebook page, and you can check out my website, agprst.weebly.com. I hope you enjoy the episode. The Performance Rehabilitation and Strength Training Podcast provides a platform for some of sports medicine's most influential individuals to collaborate. Tune in as some of the field's most well-renowned rehabilitation professionals, strength and conditioning coaches, and athletes come together to discuss the integrated world of performance physical therapy and strength and conditioning. Welcome to another episode of the Performance Rehab and Strength Training Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Jett, and today I'm sitting down with Dr. Aaron Horschig to discuss differentiating between squat and deadlift mechanics. Dr. Aaron, I appreciate your time, my man.
Hey, Alex, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Before we dive into some lower body mechanics here, do you mind giving the listeners a short history about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm a weightlifting fanatic, competed in this sport for over 11 years, turned physical therapist, and my goal every day is to help athletes get out of pain, move better, and basically find their true athletic performance. So while probably most people know me from Squat University, my day-to-day job during the week is actually working as a physical therapist. So I treat athletes that come to see me from all over the world, usually dealing with some sort of injury that they've dealt with from weight training, and just help them try to get out of pain and rebuild back full capacity to do the things that they love, which for most of us out there, that's lifting weights.
Lifting weights. I love it. Yeah. If anybody who's not on this boat, who hasn't been following you for a while, you're seriously behind. You're one of the reasons I actually went back to PT school, believe it or not. I was following your stuff for a while. So
I'm honored to hear.
Yeah, man, this is awesome to sit down and actually have a discussion with you. So we'll just kind of dive into it here. And before we really get into the mechanical side of things, can I just get your opinion on how you like to really assess your athlete when they walk in the door? Your movement screen, your tissue loading considerations after the injury or during the injury for some of these weightlifting athletes, they're working through their pain. You know, so kind of where do you go whenever you first get your hands on these athletes?
I mean, the first thing we do, obviously, is just listen to people. So that subjective is so key, understanding all the mechanics that go into how someone could develop pain. I guess we'll talk strictly about injury, you know, understanding everything that's going on in that person's life. You know, is it just the gym, or do they have a lot of stresses in their life as well that may be not allowing them to recover properly? Because that's just as important as the stresses that are put on their body to develop these injuries in the first place. We got to think more than just what's going on within the weight room, but then understanding, you know, what their goals are, their loading history, their injury history, because that plays a big part. You know, you look through any type of research, the number one risk factor for a future injury is a prior injury. Yeah. You know, so understanding what's been going on, you know, is this a chronic back issue? Is this something that just flared up a couple weeks ago? What are their lifting goals? What are their lifting habits as far as how often they're lifting? Are they pulling two-a-days with Bulgarian method type of Olympic weightlifting? Are they doing a minimalism approach? Something like Marty Gallagher preaches a lot of powerlifters are gearing into. It's, you know, more like a big one-time a week type of training. So understanding that can be key to more so than just, you know, before we ever get to the movement. But once we're done with that, you know, I take a very movement-based diagnostic system to heart. So it's just something that, you know, I've not come up with on my own. Stuart McGill, Kelly Starrett, Shirley Sarman, Greg Cook. And the idea basically is to take a step back and watch how someone's moving first. So I don't care if they're coming to me for ankle pain, knee pain, hip pain, back pain. We're going to watch how they move. So I'm going to have someone get out of their shoes, which I think is a big thing that we need to do as physical therapists, is just watch how someone moves without the constraints of their shoes, whether that's a, you know, a Nike running shoe or even a weightlifting shoe that most Olympic weightlifters are always within. And I'll watch them do body weight movements. I'll watch them do double and single leg squats. being sure to understand that the body is something that we should be able to control on single leg as well as double leg. So that's another thing. A lot of strength athletes, they live double leg, right? We squat, we pull, we clean, we jerk. That's all on two legs. But the squat also is a fundamental movement that should be performed on one leg. While I don't expect everyone to be able to do a pistol squat, they should have the capability to perform a basic single leg squat close to parallel with good mechanics, good balance, good knee control, things like that. Mm-hmm. And then also, depending on the person, how they're presenting, I'll often get a bar on their back and watch the move. I mean, Chris Duffin told me load can be an incredible teacher. And what he means by that is it can really expose a lot of things that we often don't see with just body weight movement and with shoes on. And again, this is something that I think a lot of physical therapists struggle with because they don't come from the strength conditioning side first. So they don't understand necessarily how important load is, not only as a performance tool, but also as an evaluation tool. And then also most physical therapists don't have access to things like that.
Yeah.
And you walk into most physio clinics across the US, you're not going to see a squat rack. You're not going to see kettlebells over 30 pounds, you know? So I think these are things that can be very helpful, not only in the rehab process, but also in the screening process to help us really illuminate problems that we can then take to understand where we need to go from a rehab standpoint. So from there, once we've done movement, right, we're seeing small things. We're looking at everything from the feet on up. I'm looking to see the person's foot control, which way are their toes pointing? Are they the same? Are they different? Are they excessively turned out? Are they extremely straightforward? I'm watching their foot control. I'm watching their weight balance. Are they going too far towards their heels and their toes are flickering? Are they going towards their toes too much and I can see their heels pop up? I'm watching their weight. Are they shifting side to side? Does one of their hips become more prominent because maybe they have an impingement, so their pelvis is rotating differently? You know, all these things are things that you have to have a good trained eye for. What is it? Yogi Berra said, I can see a lot from just watching.
Yeah.
You know? But I mean, as weird as it sounds, like that's very true. And it takes a trained eye to see this. And then from there, we then break down the body systematically in order to really try to uncover what the problem is. And the first thing that we teach in physical therapy school should be taught, right, is the idea that if I've got knee pain, the last thing I'm going to do is look at that knee. Mm-hmm. I'm going to look at the ankle. I'm going to look at the foot. I'm going to look at the hip. I'm going to look at the balance. And then maybe I'll touch the knee. But that allows me to really understand, well, what's going on at the knee by looking at how it's being influenced by all the joints elsewhere in the body. So, for example, we did our movement screen. I looked at the squat maybe. And then I'm going to break down. I'm going to look at ankle mobility. We'll look at tibial rotation. I'll look at hip mobility. I'll look at glute coordination with something like a single leg bridge test. And that allows me to sort of understand all the influences that may be contributing to that person's knee pain. And then comes the very critical side of things, which is also the test retest that a lot of people miss. So yeah. Let's say you find someone has a lacking of internal rotation, pretty significant amount. They got a lot of internal rotation on one side. They got a very minimal on the other side. And that's the side with pain. All right, well, let's see. Let me find something that hurts. Let me do a single leg squat. Okay. What's that feel like? Rate your pain. Now let's do an actual intervention aimed at that specific problem we found. Let's try to improve your hip internal rotation. And then immediately, does it get better? Yes or no? And then go back to that provocation test. Do that single leg squat again. Does it feel different? So that allows me to understand, okay, this limitation that I found, this is or is not directly connected to the symptom that person is having. So that way you can really formulate your idea of, okay, this person had a limited internal rotation on their painful side, and yes or no, it is directly connected to their symptoms. So that way we can sort of have a more clear picture of where we need to take our rehab plan. So from a standpoint of what are we doing, we're taking a step back first, mm-hmm. and we're viewing the entire body. We're looking at movement. And then from there, we break down the body systematically, whether you want to go top down or bottom up, it's all on you. And sometimes it's going to change based on the person that you're dealing with. But you're trying to uncover from a biomechanical standpoint what specific things are leading to that person's pain. And then it's test, retest, see if you can actually modify that person's pain in real time to let you know whether or not you're on the right track.
Love it, man. I love the holistic approach. Number one, the subjective, because I'm finding every day, every time I do an initial eval, the more I can dive into certain things that catch my attention, the more I start to uncover. So just before I even get my hands on the person, I know that, there's a lot of value in that. And then I love the approach you take as a kind of a step back. How are you moving as a whole? And it paints such a more clear picture when you watch that person perform those big movements. So I can't stress enough how much value or how valuable that everything you just said was, because you ask them to do something without coaching it, they're going to tell you exactly where the flaw is for the most part. And it's been developing the coach's eye over time. Obviously that'll come with experience, but you said a lot about the foot and ankle mechanics. That's where you kind of like to look first. So can you dive into that a little bit? Some things you're looking for. I know you're looking for the stable foot, but what are some other things you're looking for there, both from like an accessory motion standpoint, you know, obviously the amount of dorsiflexion we need, inversion, eversion, anything? Like, where does your mind go when you're starting to look at that foot and really dive into assessing?
The two big things we have to understand are the relative roles of those specific areas of the body. We need a stable foot and we need a mobile ankle. Now, if we talk stable foot, the first thing that comes to mind is the tripod foot. That's the most simple explanation that most people can get. What that means is that whenever we're doing motions like a squat or a deadlift, we want equal weight spread across the heel, base of the first toe, base of the fifth toe. Now, that just means that we're going to be balanced from the ground up, like solidifying a base to a pyramid, right? One way that can really make sure that we're doing that is watching someone lift without their shoes on and seeing their weight distribution, particularly if you look at their toes, because often that's the dead giveaway that they have too much weight into their heels. Because people, whenever they squat without their shoes on for the first time, they will actually, you'll see their toes fluttering because they're not used to having their toes in the ground. And that could be for a number of reasons. First, they're so used to either driving through the heels because that's such a common cue. Or second thing, we wear shoes that actually have toe spring. So if you look at most running shoes, the toes are actually elevated off the ground. So when you are in a standing position, your toes are not flat and in line with the rest of your foot, which is how it naturally should be when you're in a standing position. So the worst thing that you can have when you are trying to perform any lift is a shoe with toe spring, because automatically you're lifting the toes from the ground. The structure of the foot is never going to be as stable as it should be. So your foundation is already lost. So that's why it's so important to get people out of their shoes, to expose them to that problem and whether or not their toes are fluttering or actually being a good, you know, ground for the entire foot. So that's number one. Second thing, what I'm looking at, obviously, like I said, ankle mobility. Now, when we're looking at ankle mobility, originally most people just think dorsiflexion, which is knee over toe. Now, I use a simple 5-inch wall test. This is something I got from Dr. Mike Reinold. And basically, you're going to put your foot 5 inches from any wall and try to drive your knee forward without your heel popping up or your knee caving in. So you have to keep your hips square and knee driving straight forward. And the reason that this is such a good test is because it is assessing ankle range of motion in a weight-bearing position. So most of the time in physical therapy school, you're taught, all right, we'll have someone on the edge of a bed and measure their ankle mobility just hanging in the air. Well, unless you're a swimmer, that amount of ankle mobility makes no actual carryover to how you're moving throughout the day. It's not going to help you walk any differently. It's not going to help you squat, bend over to pick up anything. You have to measure in a weight-bearing position. So that allows us to expose problems. And the big thing we're looking for isn't necessarily, can you touch the wall? Yes, that's going to be a good assessment of optimal ankle mobility. But the big thing we're looking for, especially in the context of injury, is whether or not there's a big difference side to side. Mm-hmm. Those asymmetries are the biggest risk factors because it leads to loading the body asymmetrically on one side versus the other. Other thing I'm looking for is tibial rotation. So that's also happening at that ankle joint. So the idea behind tibial rotation is that when you are performing the motion of a squat, now this could be a double leg squat, single leg squat, walking up and down stairs where you are coming in contact, the knees in a flexed position. As you descend into a squat, your knee's not just moving forward. It's also tilting to the side a little bit. That's the motion of abduction. And at the actual joints, your tibia and femur, your tibia is actually internally rotating, while your femur externally rotates. So they go opposite in the motion of a deep squat. So if you were to look at someone squatting, as they go down, your tibia, your shin bone is internally rotating and then tilting to the side. That's a very important motion that most people have never heard of before, because they only think of the body in this two-dimensional plane of motion, which is going forward and back. And actually, there's a lot of three-dimensional movements that are occurring. And what can happen is that if, again, you're missing sufficient motion side to side in tibial rotation, there's going to be a lot of stresses on up that can affect problems like knee pain, hip pain, and things like that. So tibial rotation is also a very important screening to look at. And the reason you have to look at both of these is because they affect one another. If you are lacking foot stability, it can impact ankle mobility. So if you have an unstable foot, it can hinder your ability to show optimal ankle mobility, and likewise, vice versa. So if you have someone who has very restricted ankle mobility, it can limit your ability to maintain a stable foot. You can try as hard as you can to keep an arch in your foot, keep an arch in your foot, but the second you hit that restriction in ankle mobility, that foot's going to give way. I think it was Gray Cook who said a stable structure will always break down in the presence of nearby immobility. So that's why it's important to understand both if we're looking for how do we create optimal movement or how do we recreate it in the presence of an injury. That's where you have to understand all three parts of the pie, I guess, that comes together, which is the foot and ankle complex.
Yeah, love it, man. Going back to what you said earlier, you perform an intervention based off what you're seeing and then retest in real time to see if you made a significant difference there. And again, the closed chain versus open chain movement, right? Obviously, squatting, deadlifting, those are closed chain movements. But do you also perform your interventions in the positions that the athlete will be moving in? Meaning, like, would you have them hop on a table and perform like an open chain intervention and retest in closed chain? Do you put any stock in that? Or are you trying to like perform like the closed chain intervention? Maybe if the athlete's lacking dorsiflexion, you'll perform like a power band, dorsiflexion stretch and closed chain. So can you touch on that a little bit?
I think it depends on the individual and what we're trying to go after. Mm-hmm. I'll give two examples. Let's say I have an ankle mobility restriction in closed chain. I'll often ask them, all right, well, what are you feeling? Is it like a pinch or a block sensation in the front of the ankle, or is it just super stiff in the backside? Now, if they had a pinch or block sensation in the front of the ankle, I'm going to do a dorsiflexion weight bearing banded joint mobilization. Okay. To clear that up, test, retest would be fine. Now, could I also do an open chain manual? Could I actually physically do a manual joint mobilization like some physical therapists do? Sure. But I want to show this person how to actually do it in a way that they can do it at home. I want to empower them through their own movement. I don't want them to rely on me for having to get more range of motion every time they come in. So that's one quick example. Here's another one that's more open chain. Let's say I'm having someone with a shoulder issue and I find they have a lat flexibility restriction. Well, one of my retest things could technically be like a soft tissue drill, like a lat rolling a ball on the back of their shoulder or something, which would technically be a little bit more open chain as far as how we're doing it, because the arm is not necessarily, my arm is freely floating. I'm not closed chain in like a push-up position. So that could be an open chain, more retest type of thing that I'm doing. So I think it depends on the position, the type of joint that we're working on. But again, it's always got to be test retest, because that's where you're going to figure out whether or not you actually made the change that you're looking for.
I want to give a quick shout out to my sponsors, Muscle Up Protein Bars and Gym Aware Training Equipment. Head to the show details and follow the links to receive your discount on all Muscle Up and Gym Aware products. As always, thanks for listening.
Yeah, love it. Calcaneal mobility, right? The bone that really allows the foot to kind of do that, like the pronation, supination. How much stock are you putting in that whenever you're watching that athlete? More so from behind, you can see if they're tipping into one side versus the other. And again, that's going to travel up the chain as well. So what are some things you do to address that?
One of the things I'm looking for is just the position of their foot in general, whether or not they're, you know, if they're having a calcaneal issue where they're collapsing over completely, that entire foot's probably going to go over. So they're going to drop into excessive pronation. Their arch is going to completely bottom out. So that's, again, where sometimes it is something that we need to work on through specific mobility drills and stability drills. And sometimes it's as simple as giving them different cues. I'll give you an example. A couple of weeks ago, I had an athlete where we were working on his squat, and he had an issue with his right hip or his left hip. And when you looked at his foot when he was squatting down, he had that excessive motion within his calcaneus. His foot was collapsing I could have gotten out and done a bunch of ankle drills first and then some tibial rotation drills, but I just asked him first and plainly before we ever assessed anything else, hey, try different cues. Try like a screw the foot into the ground, or try a spread the floor, spread the earth cue. And all of a sudden, his foot moved into a better position, allowed him to squat with more technical competency. Hip pain, back pain got better. So it's not always something that we need to chase with a corrective exercise, when sometimes it's just a very specific cue that allows the person to start moving a little bit different.
Very good point to make. Unless you know they truly don't have the ability to express that motion, there's no need to get them on the table to perform your intervention. You're essentially just wasting time.
Exactly.
Now, as far as the knee, right? Again, we're taking this ground-up approach. We already kind of touched on the tibial rotation. Is there anything else that you're looking for at the knee?
I'm looking for whether or not that person can maintain their knee in optimal alignment whenever they're lifting. So I'm watching them lift. I may be even watching their videos. If they bring in, you know, a lot of the lifters that come to me, they're filming most of their lifts. So I'm watching how they're maintaining knee position, because again, I want to see them not only in the therapy environment, but also like in real life, what's going on when they're doing cleans and snatches, what's going on when they're doing a 400-pound squat, you know, are they actually maintaining proper alignment, or is their knee dropping in? You know, there's this idea within some young therapists nowadays that like dynamic knee valgus is not a bad thing. It's not optimal by far. Our knees need to be in line with our lower body. And that's for not only performance sake, but also long-term injury risk. So we want to maintain that proper alignment. So I'm watching and observing and seeing where we're going at. That's the big thing. I'm rarely doing much actual manual assessment at the knee joint. You know, I mean, special tests maybe here and there if I really think someone tore something or has a meniscal injury. But besides that, a lot of it, it's really hands-off. It's just watching movement and then testing things at the ankle and hip.
Yeah, the knee's the middle child between the ankle and the hip. I had a professor tell me that. It just changed how I looked at everything. I'm going directly to the foot and hip first, like you mentioned earlier in the episode. Now let's move up to the hip. Hip, lumbar, the mechanics of the pelvis. One thing I kind of wanted to touch on we didn't get to yet is really like differentiating between like a hinge pattern and a squat pattern and how you initiate the two big lifts. And this is kind of where we'll get into that with the hip and lumbar mechanics. So can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest differences are really going to be just in the amount of hinging that's going on, obviously, at the hip joint. You know, with a squat, depending on the style of squat that you're using, the idea is that we want to see the barbell track over the midfoot. So if someone's performing a low bar back squat, they're obviously going to get a little bit more hinge than a high bar back squat or a front squat. Every squat is initiated at the hips, but then we have to stay balanced with that bar tracking over the midfoot when viewed from the side. Now, when we're doing a deadlift or an RDL, there's obviously going to be a lot more posterior shifting of the hips. So the hips are going to go back, the chest is going to lean forward in order to maintain that balance and optimal alignment for the entire body. So really the big thing is just the amount, I would say, of hinging with the amount that the hips are going to be translating backwards, the amount that the chest is going to lean forward in order to stay balanced. Again, understanding that our foot is the big sensory organ that's going to let us know whether or not we're shifting too far back onto the heels, onto the toes, or whether or not we're remaining balanced. A hinge from the top, so an RDL, whether or not you're, you know, getting down into a deadlift or you're squatting, body weight equally spread across the entire foot. And that's going to let you know whether or not the amount of hinging that you're performing is adequate to maintain balance within your body.
Yeah, hip displacement. And then again, that's where the squat variations come into play based off where the bar is, how the bar is tracking, and so on.
Yep.
All right. I kind of want to touch on the pelvis a little bit. You mentioned during your assessment, if you see like rotation one side versus the other, maybe in excess, and you're going to the foot first. But let's say if you clear the foot, foot's fine, and you think there is something going on at the hip, what's a common flaw or movement dysfunction you see at the hip that could be causing that?
Usually it's a mobility issue. I'll give an example. Yesterday I was screening an athlete who had low back pain, and whenever she was performing a squat, it appeared as if her left glute was just more dominant and also lower in the very bottom of the squat. And upon assessing her range of motion, she had limited hip internal rotation on that left side and actually an impingement-like symptoms, so the positive FIDIR test. So if I jammed her hip into internalization and flexed it, she had a pinching sensation in the front of the hip. So what that meant was that in the bottom of this descent of her squat, instead of being able to symmetrically move throughout that position, her pelvis, her hip was compensating in order to avoid that impingement by changing the pelvis orientation to where it appeared like the left glute was had greater volume and sort of sitting a little bit lower. So by improving her hip internalization, we just did a simple banded joint mobilization, check, recheck, better hip mobility, less pinching pain, get back onto the squat. All of a sudden we're more symmetrical again.
Yeah. And understanding those accessory motions at the joints, the, like the banded hip mobilizations are such a game changer and they seem so simple, but when you understand those accessory motions, they make such a difference in real time. Like you said, which is what you're going at with when you're doing your test retest.
Exactly.
Now, some of the accessory lifts, what are some of the things you'd like to program? And again, this is very athlete specific and goal specific. Yeah. Obviously, if you have an Olympic lifter versus power lifter versus a sport or a field athlete, but what are some of like your big, like go-to accessory lifts, core considerations that you like to put into play whenever you're dealing with your athletic population?
Yeah, there's a couple things that I think are sort of fundamental to athletes that I work with. We're talking about the core. I'm thinking the McGill Big Three is a warm-up, and this is for athletes that are healthy and for injured athletes. And the idea is that it's quick, it's simple, and it's going to hit front, back, and side. So there's no one-size-fits-all core exercise. We have plenty of different parts with the core, but the idea, especially as an athlete, is the idea of learning how to brace and create that isometric stability. And in fact, there's research showing that people, if they do these correctly, they're actually going to get stronger with their dynamic movements. So people, there was a study where they took people that did an isometric curl up, which is for the rectus muscles, the muscles on all the front side of the body, and they actually got better at doing more sit-ups. So it's not going to just lead someone to be less efficient in movements of the core, but we're teaching the body how to become a little bit more stable, especially at the lumbar spine, which is one of the issues that we see. The lumbar spine becomes injured often because we have instability that creeps in, a poor ability to maintain the structure that we have. So the spine naturally is an extremely mobile structure. But if we don't have sufficient stability, first off, we invite injury into the picture. And then we also limit our performance as an athlete because we're unable to transfer power very well within the body through that linkage system. So the McGill Big Three is an excellent one. And for anyone that's listening to this and wants to go over those, I just have a very simple YouTube video called Top Three Core Exercises to Do Every Day. Other accessory exercises. I'm a big fan of single leg and single arm movements for the reason that as a majority of the time, most athletes love to be doing double arm and double leg movements. That's where we live because that's where we push the most amount of weight. We squat, we deadlift, we clean, we snatch, we press. Those are all double arm, double leg movements. But what we often forget about are things like single leg RDLs, touchdown single leg squats, single arm presses, Turkish get-ups, single arm loaded carries. Things like that are going to expose the body to very different types of stresses. And the important part for that is it's going to help expose side-to-side differences before they ever turn into bigger problems. So you can expose, realize them, and then work to fix them to minimize these asymmetries before they can become big issues. Now, to a point, asymmetries are very normal with certain sports. So I don't want people to fear all asymmetries. For example, you're not going to be a very good baseball player if you have symmetrical shoulder mobility. Yeah. You're going to have a crap ton of external rotation on your throwing side. If you've got 90 degrees of external rotation on your throwing side, you're going to be a crap pitcher for sure. You got to have a ton of excessive external rotation in order to get that whip-like action. Probably same thing as far as internal rotation of the hip, depending on if you're a golfer, because you're always swinging the exact same way. But to a point, if asymmetries are brought out to a large degree, and depending on the type of sport you're playing, they can just increase the risk of overload of very certain tissues, and you dump into what we become sort of asymmetrical functional sport specialization, and then that's where we increase risk of injury. So it sort of depends also what type of sport they're doing, how down the rabbit hole they've gone, and whether or not asymmetries are a part of the sport or not. So for example, a powerlifter should not have big asymmetries. Baseball player may have some, but then we want to make sure that their large ones are probably kept at bay so that we're not increasing risk of injury.
Love it. I'm glad to hear you say that though, because I pretty much the majority of my stuff is all single limb, single limb, whether it's upper, lower, we have our primaries for sure, but I love for the exact reason you said, you number one, you can expose a lot of deficiencies, but number two, you have to be able to have that movement coordination. I like to do a lot of corporate, a lot of sling work as well. And just being able to coordinate side to side, I think is huge, especially for this population.
Agreed.
One thing I have to ask, man, I just want to get your thoughts on it. The butt wink, right? There's a lot of, I feel like it's a gray area. I hear it's good, it's bad. So can I get your thoughts on that and what you think is going on there?
So like you mentioned, it's a big gray area because there's a lot of, it depends. I mean, if we're talking structurally, as someone reaches the bottom of a squat, their pelvis tips under. What happens is that it pulls the lumbar spine, specifically L4, L5, L5S1, into a bit of flexion. Now, the idea behind it's bad is because lumbar flexion under load, which most people are doing this with a loaded back squat, is the mechanism that can eventually predispose someone to a disc injury. So that is the actual mechanism that creates a disc bulge, a disc herniation. So that's where the bad comes in. Now, there's a lot of gray area because it's not like everyone has this like set predetermined amount of lumbar flexion movements that's automatically just going to snap a disc. So there's a lot of variation. We have to understand, how often is someone squatting? How much flexion is occurring? Is it like the tiniest little amount, or is it a huge lumbar flexion as soon as someone passes 90 degrees? You know, are they squatting once a week? Are they squatting five times a week? Squatting a little bit of load? Or are they trying to be the best power lifter or Olympic weightlifter in the world? What's their injury history? Do they have a prior history of back issues? Has butt wink been shown to be an exact trigger of their pain? Because I've had some people come in with back pain and I can tell them with precision that butt wink is their exact trigger for pain whenever they squat, because if I eliminate it, it limits their pain. So we can, with testing, understand whether or not it is an exact issue with someone or whether it's not. So there's a lot of gray area to it. But at the end of the day, we can't say, oh, don't worry about it, because it is proven in research that lumbar flexion under load over time is the mechanism that can create a pain. So it is just understanding that, how much of it's occurring, when is it occurring? Is it something that, you know, is being loaded often, or maybe only loaded a little bit? If it's a body weight squat, it's probably not going to be a big issue, you know? So there's a lot of, it depends, but I think just understanding how we need to get more context allows us to basically tell someone whether or not it's good or bad or advisable, you know, in the short term for that person.
Yeah. I wanted to get that out there, 'cause I figured there's probably nobody better in the world to address butt wink during a squat than the squat guy himself. Right. Aaron, this was an absolutely awesome conversation, man. Is there anything that you want to hit on here? Anything you want to, and I'll be sure to tag you in anything and and everything as well during in the show details, but just go ahead and let people know where they can find you and what you have going on.
I appreciate it. Yeah. I mean, so if anyone's interested in the stuff I put out, basically Squat University across every single social media platform. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, TikTok, YouTube, Twitter, any place that you can find a social media platform, I'm on there at Squat University. I've got my blog website, squatuniversity.com, with a ton of free content every single day put out on every platform, also including my own podcast.
Love it, man. Again, Aaron, this was an awesome conversation. I truly appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Podcasting is gaining more traction each day, and the beauty is anyone can do it, and it will cost you next to nothing to start your own show. I've gotten the opportunity to speak with individuals around the world that share my same passion for sports performance, and I've been able to share my message globally. Without my show, none of those opportunities are possible. Buzzsprout is the hosting website I use to launch my show. With Buzzsprout, you'll get a website that you can link your social media accounts to promote your episodes. You can track your show's stats. They list your show in all major podcast directories like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. And most importantly for me, is anytime I've had an issue or simply needed help figuring something out on their site, I reached out to them and they've always gotten back to me that same day to help me resolve the issue. So if you're thinking about starting your own show, I highly recommend using Buzzsprout as your hosting website. If you'd like to learn more, follow the link in the show details or reach out to me directly and I'd be happy to help. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the PRST Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give the podcast a follow and leave a review. You can also find my content on Instagram and Twitter, where my handle is PRST_PT. And you can also check out my website, agprst.weebly.com. Thanks for tuning in.